we have already heard a lot about the research system, both in the European context, in a very Austrian university-based context. And we will now have a panel discussion which will try to wrap everything up together and also to reflect on those what we heard and also find possible approaches to go to the future. I will first introduce the panel to you, and I will just do it in an arbitrary way as people are standing here on the podium. So the gentleman right next to me is Friedrich Faulhammer. He is here representing UNICO, the Universities Austria. He is director of the University of Continuing Education in Krems and also the co-chair of the Forum Personal within UNICO. He's also chairing Ludwig Boltzmann Society. You're the
member of the board.
I'm sorry. I made you a chair. Now you're a member. It's fine. But he's
so
working.
So no chair.
Not a chair.
A
no more chairs.
Member.
No more chairs. No more chairs.
No more chairing.
Many of you will maybe know him. He used to be Sektionschef in the Ministry for Education, Science and Research. I don't know what the name was back then, since the name changed
there was some sport,
25 times since I realized. I will not introduce Manuel Heiter to you because he was introduced this morning. I already introduced Ulrike Feld, so I will continue with Mostafa Munir Sharaf. He is executive director and former chair, I hope this is right, of the Marie Curie Alumni Association. He has worked in academia, he's worked in industry, he has worked for non-profit organizations, not only in Austria, but also in Belgium and the Netherlands. He is involved in a project called Secure, Sustainable Careers for Researchers Empowerment, and he is co-leading a work package of the Quara Boost project. And he's also an independent expert of the mutual learning exercise of the European Commission on knowledge valorization. And he today will also, or very much so, represent also the view of younger researchers, since most other people are coming from more an institutional side. The last but not least on the panel, Jürgen Janger. He's a senior economist and research group coordinator at the WIFO, the Austrian Institute of Economic Research, and he has authored numerous presentation journal publications on research policy, on higher education and technology forecast, and also social change. He is heading the Project Secure that I just told you about. He's just a contributor, he's not heading it. Everything wrong on my
she
list here. I'm making everyone an executive. he was one of the experts who was giving input into our working group and talking about some of the many studies and research he did on research careers. So this is our prestigious panel here. And we will first talk among us, and then, of course, we will always have the opportunity for you to ask questions to the panel. And maybe I can start with you, Manuel, and bring it back to the European perspective. You have heard the recommendations today, and you had a translator. I hope this worked fine, since we were doing some of this in German. So how do those recommendations relate to the European state of play and what's going on there?
Thank you very much, Caroline, and again, all of you, and also the panel members to be in this conversation. I believe just the fact that you in Austria have set up this group is a very important shift.
Can you hear? Does it work?
Yes.
Yes, okay, good.
So just the setting up of the group and the existing of the existence of this report per se is a significant and achievement, and I do believe that it can be an example for many other member states. Although this is as I tried to show early this morning, a true European reality, we know that it has been difficult to bring governments into this decision together with the bottom up of the research and academic institutions. So my point is that the existing of such a report is an example, particularly in a country, as I have clearly shown this morning, which is in a quite advantage compared with the rest of Europe. The situation of Austria, Germany, Sweden and Belgium are the countries with more, with the highest values of the funding per researchers and the highest volume of research. So if you are feeling this problem, please believe the others are really having this real problem. So it's an important sign for Europe at large that yourselves put together this program. I also understood that this is a mix of a bottom-up and top-down initiative. So it's a bottom-up with a number of university and university representatives with a clear understanding at a top-down ministerial level. And those examples in, say, policy design and policy governance are important in many other regions and countries in Europe. Now, I can say that I will sign all your recommendations. There is nothing really upset. But you have also not faced the most critical issue, which is precarity, which I believe in Austria is not as serious as in many other parts of Europe. And I bring here the two questions I launched in the morning, but to answering them, we need data. Mm-hmm. And it will be very important for you to provide data, case studies, and more than statistical data, because we know that current statistical offices are not empowered to do this type of analysis because the OECD and the Eurostat don't have this type of data. Only institutions themselves can provide data. That is the reason why the CESAR survey asking volunteers and volunteer among their members to provide case studies, examples of good practices in Europe, because usually we approach this topic in a bad way, saying we are a disaster. And certainly the average issue shows that we need to be concerned, but there are very good case studies in Europe that can be turned into a lesson and can be extrapolated. So the important thing for me, and I see that in your report, you have several references to case studies. That is very important because in Europe, I'm sure that there are many interesting case studies, pilot projects, and initiatives to foster better careers. So the average situation is not uniform, and we have it's important to identify those case studies to provide examples. And again, either through the ongoing CESAR survey or independent by yourselves, put data and case studies on the agenda because they provide important evidence for building up policy. And this is this important question of having data and the evidence so that we can help the formulation and make the necessary advocacy of new policies, either for research assessment or for funding of institutions.
Thank you.
Certainly
very much.
You don't touch on those two topics, but I believe that should be the next step.
Thank you very much. So maybe I can address you, sitting here as a rector, and hearing that really what we're talking about are luxury problems compared to other European countries, but are they luxury problems or are they hot topics in Austria? And which one did you identify from what you heard that you say this is where steps should be taken?
Well, thank you very much, first of all, for the invitation. It is a great pleasure to represent the Forum Personal, the UNICO Forum Personal this afternoon. And first of all, I would like to hand my best wishes from our chair, Gerda Müller. She was with us this morning, but she unfortunately was not able to be here at the panel. And so she asked me if I could represent her. So this is the first disclaimer I want to make. And the second one is that I feel extremely comfortable to be a part of this discussion here, not only because I had the possibility to meet so many friends from former times and actual times, but I have here the luxury situation that I'm speaking not on my own, but on Unico and on foreign personnel. So it was in many cases the case in my former time in the ministry when I had to represent the minister. So every problem those night was very nice to get it because it wasn't my problem. I could hand it to the minister coming home. And now what I will listen in on some problems here in the discussion, I can get it, take it to Unico. And as my president left the room, so I'm completely free.
To report whatever you've heard. Yes, yes.
Very free. So, but to become more serious, yes, of course, it was good to hear that some of the problems which we are discussing in Austria as well are, in comparison, luxury problems in relation to some other countries. But I would like to share some observations. In total, I can say that all what you did making these recommendations, I think that we can all be very thankful for this working group, because there is a lot of ideas, a lot of examples, a lot of recommendations, which we can partly, I think all of us can partly, at least partly, think about it, implement it into our organizations. But the problem I see is, as you mentioned, the situation is not uniform. And when you showed the slide with all the organizations in Austria working together in this working group, and you didn't, I think, have all the possible organizations in the working group.
Almost,
but not all. So it's really diverse in Austria as well, not only in Europe, but in Austria, maybe very, very diverse. And therefore, it could be a little bit dangerous to look at some example. Well, that's nice. I take this into my organization, but maybe the nice example in one organization would not fit in the others. And so we should be very careful when we are looking to this, all these recommendations, what are maybe successful in a certain surrounding. It must not, or it cannot obviously be successful in any surrounding. That's one observation. The second one is, we are very often talking about Europe, European research area. Great. We are talking about European higher education area, and we try to compare what is running good in Europe and what is maybe better in US or in China. We have to be aware of the fact that there, in legal terms, no European research area is existing. There is no European higher education area existing, because it's the responsibility of the member states working within research and working within education and higher education. So you have to see that when the ministers of education come together in Brussels, Council of Ministers of Education, they have to decide almost nothing, because this is the responsibility of the member states. So if we really want to go a next step of creating a really European research area, where we then can say there have to be some directions for European institutions which have to be gone, we have to develop this situation that Europe maybe goes the next step of integration, that we get education, higher education, research into responsibility of the European Union. And then we really can compare. We really can compare who is more successful, US or Europe. But if we stay, and I think I'm in person, and that's no, of course, you know, no position of the Unico, but all these discussions, I think we will not go further, or we will not go further to develop like US or like China or other competitors. So we are in Europe very diverse. We will stay diverse. We will look to all the possible situations. We always will compare how is it in France, how it is in UK, what is better in Austria, what is better there. And it's very useful to have all these comparisons, because then we can see what is in this place, what is in this place. We should make it transparent. And we then can be as diverse Europe very attractive for researchers from all over the world. So this is what I wanted to say on this kind of comparison of possible recommendations and taking in some possible recommendations to our system.
We will come back to what you just said. I would just like to get the panel introduced by involving everyone, but I'm sure we will revisit this. I want to come to Mostafa next. We now heard a lot of more political, maybe institutional views on this, but the people we're talking about most of the time are really young researchers, right? So how do you see, when you put on the goggles of a young researcher, how do you see those recommendations? You know the Austrian system, you also know other systems, also in view of how the situation is in Austria as compared to the outside.
First of all, thank you very much for the invitation. This is really a great event. And thank you for calling me young. That's always good to hear.
Younger, definitely. Okay, so I made the difference.
Okay, so that's always good to hear. Now, I agree with the previous speakers and about the diversity of the Europe. So the challenges are all also diverse. Before going into the details, just a very short introduction about what we do in MCAA, or Marie Curie Alumni Association. We are an international nonprofit association. We have members from over 153 countries, and currently we are more than 21,000 members. And that gives us actually unique opportunity to understand the challenges faced by researchers, not only in the different European context, different European country, but also globally. Now, this is the reason in 2019 we actually published a joint declaration together, our partner organization Eurodoc, which is called Sustainable Researcher Declaration. Here we mentioned a couple of things, and I'm glad to see that the recommendation from Austria actually addressed some of this. Now, to answer the questions, what is the challenges? I mean, if you look at it, and let's go to the very basic, who is researcher? That definition is actually different in different member states. Without mentioning name, even in our neighboring country, researchers are termed as a student. Mm-hmm. And that is a problem. That is a problem because of the topic what you are talking about, which is a working condition of researcher, that do not give them access to the proper healthcare, proper insurances. So this is one major issue, I would say, for the researchers are facing. So a basic definition. Now, the council conclusion or council recommendation published in December 18 December 2023 is a great document. But as my previous speaker mentioned, it is not legally binding. And that creates another problem from the researcher, because we also represent mobile researchers, so they see that the situation is different in different countries, and that is actually hampering the brain circulation, and there are more brain drain for that. And then, Manuel already mentioned about the precarity. This is a very, very big topic for young researchers. When I was in academia, or I started my academic career, there were a survey, if I remember correctly, from EUA or some other organization, that there are only 10 to 12% of the PhD or postdoc who finishes can have a permanent career at one point of time. I saw in another result like 5 years ago, that's already 7%. So I know that, I don't know what is the percentage right now. So the reality is that academia do not have the capacity to absorb. So we would need to offer alternative. Mm-hmm. And these alternative are there, but there is an awareness issue. Mm-hmm. And there is a structural issue, basically collaboration between academia and industry. Then there are a couple of other problems. I'll just summarize, and then we can go into the detail or challenges. The funding also, I think we all know, Austria is really great. They have a 3.9% of the GDP. But this commitment started from 2005, and we are in 2024. Only four countries actually went over the 3%. So ultimately, that is hampering the research and researchers. Yeah. So we need to have a mechanism to promote, if we really want to promote a researcher in academia, beyond academia, we need to have more funding. That's as straightforward as it is. And we saw that For example, there are always, I mean, Manuel and I were part of a bit of an advocacy group in the past Horizon Europe Cut, and there we always needed to convince the finance minister what is the percentage, why they would need to put money in research. There is a Eurostat statistics which says that 1 euro invested in R&D actually comes back in 15 euro in return on investment. Well, not that year, but within 7 years. So I think that is something to take into account. And intersectoral mobility is a challenge. We will probably talk about it in a bit detail, but one topic I would like to mention, and that's open access or open science. I mean, there are a lot of initiatives, and CA is part of the coalition S, but if you look at the global kind of trend, what is happening, if you look at in Latin America, they are much more advanced on open science than Europe. And just recently, actually, last week, one of the major private funding organizations, Gates Foundation, actually said that they are not going to pay any more the APC fees. But we are still, in Europe, we are still basically allowing that. And this is ultimately, again, if we talk about the research assessment, if you talk about the researcher career, because it's the researcher who is being said that, okay, you need to publish here and there if you want to have a quantitative metrics, if you want to have a tenure track position, if you don't have any, I mean, I have heard that, so that's why I'm saying that. If you don't have a nature or science, forget about basically a tenure track position. So if we want to address those challenges, these are the, because ultimately it's the researcher who is suffering, so we need to really address that in a way that it is sustainable for everyone. Now, having said that, there are good initiatives right now. There are, for example, initiative on and narrative CV started by the Royal Society, and now ERC is probably going into that, and I'm happy to tell you that MCAA is also working on, or actually just published last month, a narrative CV platform, which is funded by the 6 funding agencies in Europe. So it's good that the funding agency realizes these challenges, and also countries like Austria. You asked me what is the situation in Austria. I mean, being living here for more than 14 years in academia and industry, I think Austria is for a researcher in a privileged place. Of course, there are always room for improvement, but there are support structure. For example, the if you are in academia, there are now career management offices. There are Ludwig Boltzmann who are doing quite great on the transferable skills training. This is getting more and more basically traditional for the universities. There are also opportunities like Comet Center, funded by the FFG, where you can actually go to the different places. But what we need to have is a holistic approach, and that is what is missing, not only in Austria, but also in Europe. So I stop my rant here.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mustafa. And I will comment, you already mentioned money and euros at the end,
yes,
very much.
Say
so
something about
kind of a good bridge
euros.
To the economist on the panel, who's been very, very much involved in Research Curious. So it's not just we heard about the revenue, which might not be a direct one. That's coming back. We talked a lot today and also in the paper about also transsectoral mobility of researchers. So when you put on the goggle of an economist, I mean, you have it on already, but what do you see looking at the recommendations?
Do you have any other?
Yeah, so let me also first say thank you for the invitation for this great conference. It's really interesting. So as an economist, what would be most important for me is the concept, I think, of human capital, a terrible word which many people don't like, but this is basically how we think about what's happening with research careers, is when you're not in the right career, not in the right job, you don't develop your skills as well as you could, and that's bad for your income. It's also bad for society as a whole, because productivity is lower than it could be. There's something what we call job mismatch, another terrible word. But I think there's some really macroeconomic relevance to the issue of careers. And that is also because research careers are about knowledge production. So knowledge capital is another one of those important buzzwords which are crucial, I think, for an economy in the 21st century. And we do know there's empirical studies on job uncertainty being negative for knowledge production, because uncertainty leads to risk aversion when you try to do research. So these observations really led me to look closer into careers and the issue of careers. And in the recommendations we've heard today, there's a lot of very good suggestions in there. I would like to point out two. The first one is more and better early advice, earlier information. I think this would be a crucial step change for researchers. If I think back when I started, my supervisors were happy that I would work hard. They wouldn't lose a word about what I could do after the PhD. And I think if that changed, it would make a massive difference to the awareness of researchers of the opportunities they would have, they could see. Already at the beginning of the PhD, as the recommendations rightly say, talk about job market awareness and so on and so forth. There's one thing which wasn't mentioned in the recommendations, which I would just like to throw into here. And I think one of the easiest way to provide information to young researchers would be to put them into contact with alumni of the university. So not your classic undergraduate or even postgraduates, but, for example, postdocs. You should establish a monitoring of all the postdocs at your university, and over time, you build a database of all the different jobs your postdocs could go in. I mean, this is the best information source your PhDs or your postdocs could get. And then, even better, put them in personal contact, and that's already your entrance card into a different job. That would foster intersectoral mobility, I think, and it would be quite easy to set up, I think, just requires some time to build up this database.
Great suggestion. It's also in the written part of the recommendations. Yes.
The second thing I would like to stress alternative career paths. It's very well described in the paper. For example, we have new functions, data stewards. We need more research management. Data scientists, all that kind of thing. I think there's a lot of potential within the organization to provide more permanent roles, which would be good for scientific productivity. One thing I do miss a bit here is the life cycle perspective. Do we all need to do everything what we are asked to do at the same time? This was really much the topic of the previous presentation by Ulrike and Max. You know, there's a host of expectations. You should do research, teaching, third missions, blah, 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 all that. But do we need to do all of this at the same time? And I think there's a big role here for flexibility over your life cycle, over the time you work. For example, you might do more research when you're younger, and as you grow older and get more experience, you may get more interest into teaching. And we also, so my issue is also that we only talk about younger researchers, but that's only one side of the story. Yeah, that's only one side. We also need to talk about the older researchers and what they do. So as soon as they are tenured, we forget about them. No, they also have a role. They have a duty to make room for younger researchers. And if there's a flexibility with respect to the tasks you're doing, then I think we could approach the topic of careers in a much different way as we do now. And there's one, coming to legal commitments, yeah, which are very important. In Austria, for example, I think it's legally, the teaching time is legally stipulated by 8 hours. So why is it not possible to do more? I think you can do less, yeah, if you're good and you get a grant and so on. But why should you not do 10, 12, 15 hours when you do less research? Why not? And use the resources which are freed up by that. Use these resources for younger researchers. Just some simple, you know, stuff to
thank you.
Stimulate the discussion.
So I will go on to Ulrike. And I really think I'll ask you something different than I wanted to say, because Jung-Janga just said something which might be very interesting to you, given that you have a new, almost new, ERC Advanced grant, and you're not exactly the prototype young researcher who does a lot of research and then goes
recently
all the way into teaching.
Into this other category,
And you also have been on ERC panels as a jury member for a very, very, very long time.
Years or so.
And so you see how evaluation is really done, how life cycle actually of research is promotes. I would be interested to also hear, where do you see the biggest gap between how it is and how the desired future could be?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I would, before I try to answer that, I will want to say something about how we know about whether we are in a good situation or not. This is a really important question for me. So we take the BIP or the GDPR or the GDP or whatever. We also know that this is one, the economist might help me here, this is not a very good measure because it's so different by country what factors into what the rise of that says and the percentage also of it. So it's not a very good measure. Then the second is, of course, due to projectification, so the fact that most of our research is financed through projects, the degree of very young people that goes in is extremely high. It's getting higher. And that's why all the countries in your graphic go like that, because the balance between the fixed higher salaries and the early stage salaries are kind of... And so we have to really go in depth and look at the numbers. And I'm saying that why? Because we just had in Austria counts as one of the richest countries. It's always told us. And then yesterday I switch on the TV, or no, the day before, the week before, I can't remember, I'm told that 250,000 people live at or below the poverty line. So how do we deal with the fact that the research system is well off and the fact that a lot of people speak to poverty, precarity, or whatever you want to call it. So there is a systemic thing going on below, beyond, via, however you want to see that. So I think we need not just the numbers, we need a careful look of the articulations between the kind of aggregated numbers and the lives of people below. And I think this is a conversation we need to have. And I think this is really, really important. Then we spoke about the Europe and the European landscape. And I think not only, I'm not so convinced, to be honest, that we should go towards a European whatsoever, because we love to speak about shared European values. I have not found them yet, but I'm looking for them for many years now. And it's also the funding landscapes are fundamentally different if I go to Germany, if I'm in Austria, if I go to Italy, if I go to probably Portugal, I don't know, I know less, but I know they are fundamentally different. And so we have to consider what kind of research gets funded, how, and what are the realms of the possible. Then the next is the tension we have between what you spoke about, institutions and funding schemes. So there is a debate whether the ERC should now decide which people we should hire at universities, or we should think about universities whom we want to hire. And then we got back to what I said, the pass form or whatever. It's kind of an interesting question. Is it automatically the right choice if I say this person had an ERC grant, this person had... I mean, Marie Curie is a bit different because it's about mobility very often. And so it's also a different kind of skilling and learning, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm just saying, we have to think, universities as institutions have to think about themselves also slightly differently. So we need to find a way how to speak about these things and how they articulate. Then you opened up about 1 euro comes in return by 15. I agree totally. In the current political situation, who do you think waits for 7+ years to see the return if the legislation period in good times is as long as the law foresees, and in not so good times, it's even much shorter? And this is across Europe the case. It's not something, I'm not speaking only about Austria here. So there is this wish to see an immediate return, and this is a very bad thing if we think in science like that. And that trickles down to young people also, that they think they have to show immediately, and they have innumerable, I've been part of the mentoring scheme, and I worked with 3 young female physicists. And it was very interesting for me because the questions are always about what can I do wrong? What can I? So it's not about inspirational thinking. It's really about fear. And it's a lot of fear mongering here going on about can I do something wrong? Do I do the right things? Do I have all my eggs in the basket? What will be waiting for me? I think we do not produce creativity both on the side of temporalization and on the side of the whole discourse we have. So it's I think this is really... And the US, just to be fair, it's a huge promissory machinery. You can be a postdoc plus six and have never contributed to any social scheme. Just be fair. So you need to work until you're 80 in order to get a decent retirement. So let's kind of compare what's comparable, in a sense, and kind of pay attention to what we want, if it's really we imagine our life having 1 week of vacation and working every Sunday, or if we think about a decent life that looks differently. So let's kind of maybe balance a bit what we think a life in science should look like. And I think we need to regularly discuss about these things and to kind of work against self-exploitation practices and things like that, always in the fear that one might not be good enough when the point comes. And my last point is maybe when I was dean, I started a debate about quality in our faculty. And then I had one meeting with the postdocs. And after a really good debate we had, somebody said, can you just simply tell us how many publications we should have after 6 years? And this got me cold, I must say, because I had thought, wonderful, I have convinced them that they have to think differently. And they said, can you please tell me how many publications I need to have? And this is about because the discourse of insecurity, and I think we have produced that discourse. Mm-hmm. It's not. We have also produced it. We tell the children with 14 they need to know what they want to do, etc. And yesterday a student asked myself after my course, I have a private question. I said, okay, ask it. I said, I don't know if I answer it. And I said, would you think you would dare to change from physics to social sciences today? And I said, that's a good question. I can only hypothetically answer. But in the 80s, nobody asked about these things. So nobody ever spoke to me about a career. So I thought, like, why not? And I tried it out, and I loved it. And then I went, thought, okay, then I do it. This is, we have taken that away of the next generation in many ways. And I think this is our responsibility, and I include myself here, mm-hmm. that with the discourses we produce, we also produce these forms of self-exclusions. So we don't even need to exclude them. They self-exclude them sometimes. And I think to cherish what they can and the skills and all the things we have been speaking, I think this is so important. And I really deeply believe in that that's where we need to work towards. All right.
Maybe Mostafa can take up this question that was just raised also since you're in Quora, because I think Ulrike mentioned something which I also experienced at my own university, that it's not just the institutions that are a bit reluctant towards research assessment in Quora, taking up Quora, because it makes things so complicated and you have, I don't know, hundreds of researchers that you need to evaluate every 3 or 5 years, and you have I don't know how many hundred of tenuring decisions you have to take, et cetera, and so on. But also, especially the young research, they want to know when they're, you know, start, and then they have their qualification time or a 6-year contract. They want to know what's on my tick box list. And of course, this is a measure of insecurity. So how do you see what are the tackling points to get over the obstacles of implementing Quora, not just for the institution, but also for the researchers?
Yeah, this is actually a quite an intriguing discussion. I mean, I don't represent Quora, but what we see also from a researcher's point of view, it's not only the check boxes, but also there are non-traditional outputs mm-hmm. which are not included in the current research assessment. For example, I can talk about right now the researcher's life is a bit difficult because everyone wants a researcher to be a communicator to. In provide input in policy, on science diplomacy. There are not one researcher doesn't need to do all, but these are not included in the assessment. And that includes one of the traditional thing what we were doing for quite some time, supervision. Mm-hmm. Supervision is not included in the assessment. MSCA mm-hmm. unit and NCAA actually produce a supervision guideline. And to be very honest, the question is very difficult to answer at this moment. But I think what I can see that right now Quora has different community-driven working group, which are basically tackling different aspects. Because I remember we had a very good discussion with Jean-Pierre Bourguignon that, look, the assessment in mathematics is completely different than the assessment in material science, or even, I mean, not even the broader topic. Even within the topic, it's different. So how this will be done? Now, I think it's a very early days, to be very honest, for Quora. I think we need to provide them the time, and especially they need to have this mindset that, okay, there are no one-size-fits-for-all. I mean, it's not only the subjects, but also the national, in a way, national evaluations or assessments. This needs to be different, and there needs to be enough scope for customization. That would be one thing. And the second thing is that basically the traditional output, if you also look at it, we need to think it a bit differently. We talk about the open science, but not only the research publication, there are other way of communicating your result, not only to the public, but also to the researcher. And the skepticism right now, I mean, I think the whole community in that sense, by community, I mean the higher education and research community, in that sense, do not have a consensus that what should be changed, mm-hmm. and we need to work towards it. Mm-hmm. That's the only thing I can say at this moment. There are also like another aspects, and that is like traditionally speaking, that we talk about intersectoral mobility. We talk about, by the way, just a comment in MCAA, but also in other young researcher organization, we do not call alternative career, because if you look at percentages, the academia is the alternative mm-hmm. career. So it should be career outside academia. I'm sorry, but that's...
Yes, absolutely. That's exactly. What we saw this morning on the figures, yes.
Exactly. So when we talk about the career outside academia or intersectoral mobility, for example, intersectoral mobility is not included in the assessment. Now, MSCA is a wonderful program. They have a secondment opportunity, and that's the reason researchers can go to another sector, have a secondment, do not only actually if a researcher, we know researcher who started their research project and then they did a secondment at a policy organization because they want to move it. But there are very few organizations like that, or very few funding schemes like that, who, and also evaluation system like that, who actually recognizes that. So if I can list down all, this would be probably already more than 50, but the Quora itself, the community itself, come to a census, come to a discussion that what should be included and how to tackle that. I don't know if that answers
Thank
your
you.
Question,
Great.
But yeah.
And it really opens the next question. I don't know if anyone wants to comment on this too, but otherwise I would ask, you just said something that can help is giving funding for mobility, but what else can we do, or what are the obstacles that can be addressed? Maybe... I don't know if you have a vision of what it is in different countries. There might be some countries where there is more transsectoral mobility. Is this just because there are no jobs in academia and they have to go?
More than
in the microphone.
Thank you. More than the job situation, you need to understand the socioeconomic context mm-hmm. of the people. And essentially, it ends up to be an availability of resources issue. Actually, regarding the initial comments on the European context, and I will call more than the European research area, the different European ecosystems. And that diversity should be definitely a value to explore and not a bad issue. We should more and more understand the building up of these very diversified ecosystems as a unique value of the European of the European system. So when ministers meet in Brussels, the most important point is every 7 years where the European budget is defined. And then it's just to follow up that budget, because providing funding, not directions to universities, because I believe they should be full autonomous, but providing funding is very important. And ultimately, the European budget is created through contributions from different member states. And certainly what we can argue, and the OECD has been arguing this very much for the European context, is usually are the treasuries and the Minister of Finance that more influence the research and higher education policy because of the definition of the budget. But the main function of governments and of governance in this area, which is an area that should value and more should value seriously the autonomy of the institutions is to provide the necessary funding and the assessment questions. And regarding the assessment, although the work of Quara has been very important to open this debate beyond quantitative assessments, and that, as Ulrich mentioned, that was made by the academics themselves to simplify their life. We need to be very clear. The current assessment system, very much based on quantitative assessments that at least many of us, and I'm certainly, we criticize, I'm also an academic, we should understand that it was a result of the academics themselves. And today, all the difficulty in getting a consensus in terms of the assessment and of the Quara policy action is essentially within academia. It is not outside the academia, because we know that a non-quantitative assessment scheme is much more difficult and much more time-consuming than a well-defined assessment. But again, beyond the quantitative questions, I have brought this morning another issue which will be critical for what we are discussing here and is becoming a key issue not only in the research but in general in industrial policy. When we look at youngsters, is the quality of the jobs. And in this case, the quality of research and teaching jobs. And we need more and more to introduce this discussion in the assessment methods and eventually in the funding schemes. But the idea that the quality of research jobs can be or should be considered in parallel with the quality and the impact of research results is per se a breakthrough in the current assessment schemes.
Thank you. We talked about transsectoral mobility today a lot and also about early on career counseling, etc. But as we see from the figures, actually going outside of the university, although it's not always voluntarily, works kind of well in many countries. But what about coming back to universities? It rarely ever happens, I guess. It works with universities of applied sciences, I see, in Austria, because usually it's people not going back and forth, but having two feet in two different continents, so to speak. How would you address this? And maybe I can start with Mustafa, who's experienced it himself. You're a traveler between the worlds, so to speak.
Okay. Yes, this is very rare, actually.
Yes, of course.
Especially the bidirectional mobility or going from academia industry to academia it does exist, but it is very, very rare. The mutual learning access. I mean, I myself is coming back actually to Wien next week as a researcher. So this might be an example. But we saw in the mutual learning exercise with the member states that there are in here and there some program or secondments. Yeah. So the idea is that if we want, first of all, why we need to have that? Because, I mean, the one example could be the COVID vaccination, if you look at it, that the researcher would need to collaborate within the different sectors. And the best way is to have this kind of breaking the barriers of the language between academic and the industry or other sectors. And there are different ways. For example, secondment could be one way. And then making a collaborative platform. For example, in Greece, they have this, if I'm not wrong, the term is called Elevate Greece. So where you have a platform for academia and industry, and there are some countries has basically specific options that you can do a 1 year or 2 year sabbatical in completely in different sector and bring back this into the academia. I mean, one of the prime example, probably not really in academia, but for example, in US, there is a SSS fellowship on science diplomacy, for example. But then there is also Jefferson Chair, so professors spend time in the State Department and then goes back to academia. But the important thing is that if you would really like to encourage that, then there need to be a space for the incoming from outside sectors. And that, considering the current academic environment, is very, very, very challenging. Because, again, comes back to the issue of assessment, how we assess each index impact factor. And the person, if they're outside of the academia, they probably do not have a traditional CV or traditional publication at that period of time. That's actually the reason why narrative CV are getting more traction in the past couple of years. And MCAA basically now have a peer-to-peer exchange platform for narrative CV. So it's a mentoring platform. It's free for any researcher in the world. And there we would like to encourage that how to actually write a customized CV in a narrative way for different sectors. So hopefully that would be something to take into consideration.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Maybe I can, from the Austrian situation, is it easy or not from industry back to university? I would say that it is possible. There is no legal obstacle about that. And we see that at some universities, it's quite common, especially in the technical field. Mm-hmm. Technical universities, very often there are managers from the industry and then they become professors. For instance, the former rector of Technical mm-hmm. University, Graz, Harald Kainz, came from the industry and became a professor and rector as well. So I think this is possible. And if we accept autonomy and autonomous decisions about strategy, it's up to the university if the university wants to support this way or not. Another model could be, we see it in some universities with the so-called practice professorship, mm-hmm. where managers from industry, from business, come to university with a very small number of hours to share their experience with students for 5 years, and then they are fully back to industry. So maybe it's not the same, could not be the same model for professorships in the field of history or theology, maybe. But in some fields, it's quite common. Maybe with regard to the quality of jobs mm-hmm. and how we can improve the situation, especially for young researchers. I think that if you look to the labor market at all, at least in Austria, we face a situation that it becomes more and more difficult to be attractive for future employees. And it is very often, you can read it in newspapers, that the labor market changes from an employer market to an employee market. The employees look around. You have to hire and not they have to apply. And so I think we at universities, there is no alternative than more look to what the young researchers want. Because if we don't look, they will not come to our universities anymore. So it's maybe it takes time that we realize this change, but I think there will be no alternative. And maybe I come back to the European perspective very, very shortly. Yes, you are true. The main decision, especially in the field of education, is the decision on money, because the member states did not decide to move the power to the European Union. But the only possibility the European Union now has to influence into the education systems is money. It's like China. They do a lot of money and want then to influence. And especially in the research funding, yes, you are true, but the main funding for universities is still the government funding by the governments. And therefore, it's always a kind of a discussion. What shall universities do? Should they follow the money of the governments or should they follow the money of the European Commission? And with regard to autonomy, we now face a development, especially in the research framework program, that this kind of mission orientation could be a danger for autonomy, because then you are not autonomous. Yes, you are autonomous in university if I apply or not. But you have to follow the mission of the European Commission if you want to take the money. So this could be a danger for autonomy for the European universities in future.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Just contribute for this discussion in 2 points. I will say that the case of the missions and the mission-oriented innovation policy in terms of funding represents less than 10% of the European Framework Program. So only a very small part of the program is mission-oriented. And in that discussion, some of you may remember some 8 or 9 years ago, that was exactly, this should not be taken for the full program, is one part of the program. If you speak with the people, even in this country and in Germany, in the cancer research centers or in the sustainable cities movement, they found it, the budget is very small. But the mission-oriented can be one part, not the full program. And today, the discussion is how far it should be increased or not, because many important stakeholders ask for an increase of the mission-oriented policy. But I will assume that the autonomy of academic and research institutions is always present in understanding participate or not participate. In terms of the mobility from business to university, we need also to look at data. Don't forget that the figures I presented are in terms of funding per researcher are average figure. But the OECD and the Eurostat have data divided in the private sector and in the higher education sector. And the difference is enormous. So people don't return for a job which is less paid. Okay. And that is the reason why many universities, technical, but also schools of business and economics, has invented this idea of the invited professors, because they keep being paid with salaries in the private sector and provide a part-time or sometime at the higher education, but no one wants to go to a worse salary, and the salary differences are enormous.
Yes.
Enormous, again, with notable exceptions.
For sure, they are enormous, and probably one should all should become football players, then it would even be better. But I still stay in my job, to be honest. So I would like to pick up one thing, namely the question of the mission orientation, because I would not only calculate it in terms of money, but I would also look at it in terms of discourses about utility of research, about does research really contribute to society. This has become a much bigger topic than just the money topic. So it's you cannot say these 10% are actually the EU funding is only a part. This has swapped over to a lot of other assessment, intuitive assessment exercises. When you have two projects, you think, that sounds really more relevant or so. Okay, so this has a real impact, and I think it's not a straightforward intervention into the freedom of whatever you want to call that, of research or whatever, but it is impacting what we think is worthwhile doing research on, etc. And this has created the debates about whether certain kinds of research are still kind of worth funding. And I remember still back in the 90s, early 2000s, we had this Orideenfach discussion, which is extremely fascinating just to watch as a debate. So it's really interesting. So what do we think we need as a cultural repertoire of knowledge generation? And I think this is a serious debate that is to be held regularly from institutional side about what do we think as a whole we need, because we cannot only think in this short-termish idea, like now today we have this problem and so everybody goes into that and we see this kind of fashion trends, etc., etc. Now, what I also find interesting is to talk again back a bit on value. Because when you look at the Austrian academic system and the university system as a whole, we still hold on, in comparison to many other European countries, to the idea of an open university. And we still hold on to this idea of being able, when you have the formal kind of prerequisites, to be able to choose to do a PhD. I know a number of countries who do not allow PhDs if they have no funding into the university. So this is a question which we need to politically debate. It's not something which I can say I find it better A or I find it better B. We have to think about what that means. Because, of course, this both has advantages and disadvantages. And so we need a careful balancing what we want as a society and where we see the role of universities. They are public institutions, most of them are public institutions, the large majority of them are public institutions. So I think this is a larger societal question. But of course, that also brings about the number of people who will never, as a pure number game, have the possibility to enter into the system. And now for me, something that puzzles me personally is the question, like, how do we balance institutional choices with funding choices? And so we have these cases where people are successful in getting external funding, but the institution still has no place for them. And so I think we need a serious debate about how these things relate to each other. And we, so far, we haven't had that, to be honest. We regulated it, and I already said what I think about the regulation, but we regulated it apparently or pretendedly in the name of the young researchers. I'm not so clear about that. That was the pretension. I said pretendedly in the name of young researchers to not have these long-term one contract after the other. But we have to ask ourselves seriously, what kind of education system do we want? How do we invest in it? What kind of openness should we keep? On what level? Because we should not forget that what today a bachelor is was the matura maybe 40 years ago or 50 years ago. So there is something changing in our societies, and we have to think about that and think about what that means for university as places of teaching and learning and doing research. And I think this is a debate we have not had at all. We just have some legal constructions and somebody decides that we do it like that.
Can I comment to Ulrich? With an example, the Bologna process in Europe. And we need to go back. When three European education ministers met in Bologna and launched the idea in 1998, it started as a question to European universities. And it was asked to university leaders to move along. 10 years passed. The universities have not agreed in any potential. And therefore, the ministers of education in Europe have decided in 2005 to get national systems. And that was the process, the Bologna process, as today we know. And because I was in government and I am a great defender of university autonomy, we should recognize that Bologna has become a national, not a European issue. The idea is European mobility, but the systems are national and was decided in the European Council that each government should decide its own system because the universities have not been able to produce the initial idea that should be fully bottom-up. So certainly we are looking at complex social processes that when we bring different people and different constituencies, the answers will be different about which education system we want. And that is also the beauty of our education and university systems, that each university has their democratic governance system, which vary a long time. But this is not a straightforward top-down decision that will not happen definitely. But the Bologna process, which ultimately I'm a great supporter, and I believe probably here half of the people is a great supporter, and half is not, is becoming a real part of the European identity because of the mobility of the youngsters across Europe.
Thank you. I think it's time to also take questions from the audience. Well, there is a question in the back already. Thank you for starting. The Herr im schwarzen T-shirt. Now everybody's up again in case you fell asleep.
Well, thank you very much. I think this was a very interesting discussion beginning in the morning, and the whole spectrum of opinions and narratives. On one aspect I would like to focus is the leadership of a university. So to which extent does a leadership of a university differ nowadays than in comparison 5 to 10 years ago? and more particularly, what are innovative ways to develop university leadership so to tackle issues like career development, etc. So what are here the options, possible strategies, what can we expect perhaps? So I think this is an issue not touched upon so much until now, so I think we'd be curious to learn about your ideas in that respect.
Who wants to go first?
I mean, if I understand your question as to relating to organizational structures of the university, this is indeed something which I asked myself. How can we fit the recommendations on a diversity of careers? How does that fit with the current organizational structures of Austrian universities? And so what we have basically is that universities can decide freely on how they want to structure the working units, for example, at the institute level or the departments. And what we see in reality is a mixture of organizational structures, some more hierarchical, still chair-based, others going more in a collegiate kind of organizational structure with departments. And I think it's clear that more open collegiate organizational structures will allow for a higher diversity of career paths, also more positions leading to the top, so to speak, under quotation marks. But yesterday at the dinner, we had an interesting discussion also with Manuel on even inverted pyramids, you know, having more full professors in an institute than postdocs, for example. So I think there's a lot of interesting discussions possible here.
But let me bring again, I thank you for this question of leadership. There are different types of leadership. We have here in the room an excellent example, Anna Steiger. Has just moved from the TU Wien to become Chancellor of Stuttgart. The point is, how many of these cases do happen in Europe? And this is a very important issue in my view. A few years ago, that was a study comparing Europe and America in terms of the number of Nobel laureates that get to the director level, and the difference, it's amazing, because essentially we still have a quite fragmented system in Europe, and sometimes it is not even a national system, it's an institutional system. There is a large endogamy in the process of becoming a leader inside an institution. And this is an issue which is not easy to deal, but is a critical issue. How far can we envisage in the coming decades, that will take decades, a true European system of university leadership with mobility of leaders across Europe? If that will happen in 20 years, that will be an enormous advantage, but again, I cannot speak on this system in front of Anna Steiger because she's here and I believe is one of the best examples I know in Europe these days. If you go to my country, we have made the law 15 years ago promoting that, and the universities do not want. Still, 15 years after we made the law, no single Portuguese university has recruited a rector outside their own university. If you go to Spain, it's exactly the same. If you go to Italy, it's even worse. There is no mobility at all across university leaders. So I relate the leadership very much on this context of mobility of leadership in Europe, which is a dream, particularly when we compare, we can go deeper why this is like that, why the systems are so fragmented, are so even not national, are institutional level, and essentially is also associated with the type of resources you can provide and the form of contract and payment you can give to the leadership in my view. Jorgen touched a completely different topic, which is a very interesting topic, which is the pyramid of professors at department of university level, but that will take us a lot of time, which is a completely different topic.
Yeah,
she has a microphone.
I have my own. So, I think the question of leadership is an interesting one, and it's very differently handled in Europe, because some leadership positions in other countries are professionals by themselves. While, for example, in Austria, a dean is not hired for to be a dean, but it's one of the professors has to be ready to do it. And so the debate is, how long do I do it, and do I do it, and am I good enough to do it, and does nobody hate me so that I can do it, etc., etc. It's a very fundamentally different idea of leadership that can be also exercised very differently if I do that. And I have to teach, and I have to do research next to it, and this is just expected as a side job. And of course, ideally not, but it is the fact. So this is a very different model. So if we really want to go to this mobility idea, it's really interesting to think about how can we align these things. And you would find in Denmark, for example, I've been teaching one of these courses for people who take leadership roles. And I found it super interesting how they themselves think of that job is leadership and not just doing also leadership next to being professor in XYZ. And that makes a huge difference and so. Then I wanted to say something to what you said about differentiation of professional possibilities. Yes, the interesting thing is that I would warn that we think that when we introduce data stewards, we introduce senior scientists, we need career structures for them. Because you cannot expect that somebody stays at that level for the rest of their days, it as 30 years maybe. So you need some kind of motivational part to turn that into a real life within their organization. So we need to do more than just create the jobs. We need to think of them as integral part of, and getting in, getting out, is there a possibility or not, is that forever? And that comes back to this idea, which positions are in some universities seen as administrative and which positions are seen as scientific, and all these differences. So there is a lot of tricky stuff there that we would need to think about before. And I totally think that we need a diversification of tasks, but we also need to pay attention that it doesn't become a new form of hierarchy, that you have again another layer of just service, I mean that not really seriously, so just service people. And so I think for the identity of these people and for doing the work very good, it just needs a certain value that is attached to these positions in order to turn them into something one could call a career or whatever you want to name it. I'm always prudent about that notion.
Yeah, Professor Kemper asked what changed the last 5 to 10 years, maybe. From the Austrian perspective, I would add that there changed not so much in the last 5 to 10 years. The main change was in 2002 when the new Universities Act came into force, and since then, Austrian universities are like entrepreneurial universities, and the management of the universities is done by the rectorates, which really got a managerial power, which they didn't have before. And when you mentioned that in some countries it is absolutely impossible that a person outside from the university becomes a rector, so I can say it was the case in Austria until 2002 as well. But since then, it's possible, and it happens. And sometimes it happens that a former director general of the ministry becomes a rector. So in that sense, I think that Austria became quite open to different ways of creating leadership at universities.
More questions. Here we go. First row. You're next.
Thank you. Michaelis Tsatsanis from FFG. If you allow, a comment towards the mission orientation that was raised, and in general EU research funding, and then a question related to the last thing that Ulrike Feld said. I think one of the most common misconceptions of the people that I consult as an NCP for Horizon Europe is that they think that Horizon Europe is there to fund science for the sake of science. That's only the case in ERC. Pillar 2 and most of the rest of the part of Horizon Europe funding does not fund the science for the sake of science. It's fund science in order to answer questions of policy debates or other societal relevance. And mission orientation is in the newest way of doing that. And the reason why I'm making the point is not to correct anybody, but to say that, of course, it means that the universities need to react to that. Still, we see people that are frustrated, I could say, to provocatively mention it, that they need to do policy advice at the end of their Horizon project, because they think that they are funded for doing their science. They're not funded for bringing the results to society and to the economy and the industry. So we need to take that into consideration during debates of research assessment and so on. And the question relates now back to what Professor Feld said lastly, and it's more or less the debate about transsectoral mobility brought back into the new career paths that we are building for in academia. And the question is, how big is the risk that we create radiating new paths, that they begin at PhD and they go their own way to the horizon with never meeting again? And how can we make them more intertwined so that people can move up to a whatever teaching or a research career after being 5-6 years data steward or a data scientist or whatever?
Thank you very much to this point, and I use this opportunity to invite you all and invite your friends and your colleagues to contribute for the discussion. As you know, the Commission has opened last year an audition process. They will receive hundreds of papers, but now actually I chair a high-level committee which is trying to advise on this process. So feel free to contribute, to send your own positions either as individual or in institutions. There is a well-known Austrian academic member in this group, Heinz Fassmann, but feel free to contribute with your own ideas. The question you brought as an historic pattern. And before I raise the issues why we need an European framework program, if we go back to the early 80s, it started in 84, as a small program to provide collaboration among researchers. That was the initial idea, collaboration. And we should be, in my view, very proud. It was a great success of promoting collaboration among researchers. And then, years later, it was such a success that many constituencies throughout Europe say, why not we ask more things to the framework program? And it starts the idea of European competitiveness. The Horizon 2020 introduced societal challenge. Can we ask researchers to collaborate towards societal challenges? And as we know, and as you mentioned, one of the most successful processes was the introduction in the framework program of a component for science for science, the European Research Council. Remember that it took 7 years, that discussion. It was launched after the Lisbon Strategy in the year 2000, and it was until 2007 when that program was created. So this is a process of advocacy, of contributing, and many researchers throughout Europe were very important in advocating for the creation of the European Research Council. So why today, after these 40 years, because the European Framework Program is now 40 years old, after these 40 years, the question which I would like to launch you is, why do we need an European Framework Program? Knowing that, until now, even the existing program Horizon Europe, which is the largest in the world, first, it only represents 5% of the overall European research money, because it complements the national funding, and within the European investment, it only represents 8% of the full European investment. And why it is not larger than the investment in agriculture, the common agriculture policy, as an example, and many other programs within the MFF 2021-27. And it's very important we, in my view as Europeans, to understand why we need an European framework programs. For your discussion, I will essentially raise at least four main reasons. For excellent research and innovation, science for science, and we have the example of the European Research Council, of the Marie Curie Fellowships, and also now in terms of excellent innovation of the European Innovation Council. Second, to help promoting European competitiveness, and it has been a part. We know today this is becoming a key the discussion, how far can we move to more competitiveness or not, and why we have not succeeded as much as in other fields. Third, to face societal challenges, which are not only inside Europe, but they need a global approach, particularly more and more with the question of carbon neutrality and the cooperation with the Global South per se. And last but not least, for the building up of the European ecosystems, what we have known by the European Research Area, or European Research and Innovation Area, or the European Research, Innovation and Higher Education Area, but the building up of the European ecosystems, which do include research infrastructures, but also the widening process of the countries which are still lagging behind. So at least I believe these four objectives will require and will make us European citizens the need to think on why we need an European research, an European framework program for research and innovation. The question was and will be always, if you start entering more objectives, how do you share the program among the different objectives? But I do remember that 40 years ago, this program was launched by Ruberti and many other commissioners by that time, essentially to foster collaboration in Europe. And it was a great success. It built an European identity together with Erasmus and others. And then we all, European citizens, have started asking researchers to do more and more, to do competitiveness, to address societal challenge, and so on and so forth. So the question is why we should have an European framework program and why we need more funding for research in Europe. Thank you.
Thank you. There was another question.
Just have a critical question regarding some benchmarks and also how much money do we actually spend for universities, because all of us, we say, okay, Austria really spends a lot of money, so it was 3.6% of the GDP. I'm right, or 3.9% of the GDP?
It's research altogether, including private spending.
Okay.
It's not universities. Yes.
Okay. And then what's the question? How much of this money actually flows to a researcher? Because especially in Austria, we spend a lot of money, for example, for FFG, which is a wonderful program, because this gives us the opportunity to horizontally or to go to another sector, because we are dealing, we have to cooperate with companies and so on. But just a little of this money goes directly back to the universities. Is this true? So or not?
I tried to explain this in the morning. We should be very clear. These figures are calculated with very precise benchmarks and surveys, which are done through the OECD and to the national experts in science and technology and innovation, and they all account for existing expenditure, where salaries has become the largest part. There are also capital investments in goods and in equipment. But when we speak about European statistics in science and technology, and essentially in terms of the funding situation, they follow the Frascati manual, mm-hmm. which as a quite precise definition, which took many, many years, a lot of people thinking on that through the OECD. So the answer is clear. All the institutions are asked either in the private or in the public system. There is probably some misunderstanding in different countries, but the rules are very precise these days throughout mm-hmm. Europe and throughout the world, because the United States, Latin America, China, all the world has adopted the Frascati manual today, and therefore these figures, I would say, are quite comparable with each other.
I think the question was also to the division of where the money comes from and where it goes.
So I mean, in total, we spend like 3.2% of GDP on research. But then, if you compare, so there's a lot of research money in the total system. Yeah, there's no doubt about it. But if you then look in more detail, for example, the university sector in Austria, as an example, is very large. We have like 80% of students of the total higher education system. In the university sector, that's way more than other countries. For example, in Switzerland, it's only 40%. The Netherlands, it's 30%. In the UK, you have got the research-intensive universities, the Russell Group. 35% of students are in that sector. So, and if you try to use the number of students as a scaling factor, then you find out that the research money going into universities is above the European average, no doubt. So I would say it's in the upper third, but it's certainly not very high compared with, for example, the Swiss university system, even if you control for prices, or the UK research-intensive universities, or the Danish or the Dutch universities. Research there has definitely much more resources available than we have here in Austria. And of course, it's always a question of perspective. Yeah, of course, we can say we are much better than the bottom third of the European Union. But of course, we can say we want to be a leading country. We have the ambition to be more. And so we should change funding streams accordingly. And where we are definitely at the top, almost globally, is, for example, in research funding for companies. We do a lot of public support for firms. We realize this ambition. Yeah, we give a lot of money to companies, and by comparison, we don't do the same for university research.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. Oli, bitte, was du zu sagen?
No.
Good, then we have
everything
time.
Has been said.
Time for the next question. So that's your last chance. We have about 5 to 7 minutes. If not, then I take a last round of are there things you always wanted to say and never had the chance
no,
to?
No, don't ask that question.
About research careers and maybe research assessment. Is there something, if you could have a wish, I know this is a horrible question at the end always,
yes.
If you had a wish, if the fairy came tonight after we had the aperitivo, and you can have one wish about the research careers in Austria, what would that be?
Can I start?
Sure.
Launch a unique system of assessing the quality of research jobs together with the quality of research results and the impact of results. Lead that process in Europe. You need countries like Austria to lead these examples.
Other wishes?
Well, where do I start? So basically...
One wish. Barry can just take one today.
Okay. And don't do the trick, I give you a list of the wishes, that's one wish. Okay. Oh, no, that doesn't work.
So,
Manuel that never
already,
worked in
already
my life,
says,
so.
Said the assessment, but a holistic approach and a structural link between the all actors of the research ecosystem, just to explain the collaboration between academia and industry. For example, you just mentioned about the funding. Why don't there are more funding for the industry where they are collaborating with the university or academia? So I'll stop here.
Yeah, this is a difficult one. Maybe, so it has been mentioned before, I would opt for a proper tenure track system. So like there to be one tenure track professor system and not the two others. Yeah, like we have, so have this whole 1998, 99, whatever, have a proper tenure track system and have more of that. Yeah, there's not many of these tenure track positions. That would be my...
Yeah. So then I you publish 100% professor. So if it's 99, I want a paragraph 100 professorship that kind of merges them into one. I think it is important to really reconsider what we understand under this notion of careers, its diversity, and not just look at them structurally, but understand what that means in terms of living conditions. And I think that's a really important part. So we very often invent structures, but we don't look at how these structures actually pan out within the institutions and who can live along them. And I think this would be an important kind of implementation and test. And I think we often speak about quality, but we are not so good to reassess choices we have made and really think about that. So that's a bit more a bigger wish, but...
That's okay.
You said it's one.
I didn't say how big the wish
to go
can be.
For the bigger ones.
The last wish is to you, Fritz.
Well, Manuel mentioned that we have a very diverse ecosystem in different areas. We have an also very diverse ecosystem in research in Austria. And my wish would be that we will rebuild a real ministry for science and research as we have it until 1994. In order to create an overall approach of research career development.
Thank you very much. I thank all of you for listening to our panel. Thank you very much for the panelists for the interesting question. And I hand over to Anna for the closing remarks of this event.